Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 18th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Omicron surge in hospitals. Doctors warn ERs in crisis, by Meg Wingerder. Analysis, CDC faces issue of imperfect science, by Apoorva Mandavilli. Voting rights, Senate Dems pressing ahead to debate bills, by Katie Edmondson. MLK Day, Our Democracy Stands on the Brink of Serious Trouble, by Jeff Martin and Michael Warren. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Omicron surge in hospitals. Doctors warn ERs in crisis. Physicians group wants governor to activate state's crisis standards, by Meg Wingerder, the Denver Post. Colorado's emergency rooms are essentially already rationing healthcare amid COVID-19's Omicron surge. But without the legal protection that would come if the state authorized crisis standards, a physician group told Governor Jared Polis' staff late last week. The Colorado chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians told the governor's office in a 5-page letter that doctors are having to triage which patients will receive the limited hospital beds available, and some people who would be deemed sick enough to admit under normal circumstances are being sent home. Anyone having symptoms that suggest a life-threatening illness, something like difficulty breathing, chest pain, or extreme weakness, should still go to an emergency room, said Dr. Ramnik Dalawal, president of the Colorado chapter. However, he said, staffing shortages in hospitals and public confusion about where to go for care or COVID-19 testing have contributed to a squeeze in emergency departments that impacts all patients, not just those being admitted for treatment of the virus. A statewide activation of the crisis standards of care for as short as 1 or 2 weeks would help hospitals get through the current surge, he said. We're operating in that crisis framework without the liability protections, Dalawal said in an interview Monday. The hospital crisis standards address two problems: sorting out which patients are most likely to recover even if they don't get a general hospital bed, and deciding which are so sick that they're unlikely to survive if they don't get the highest level of care. These would apply to all patients, not just people hospitalized with COVID-19. Colorado has had crisis standards for staffing in place since early November, giving hospitals legal protection if they stretch their workforce in less than ideal ways. In early January, the state reactivated crisis standards for emergency medical services, allowing ambulance workers to not transport some patients and to not attempt resuscitation if the odds of a success are low. The state has never activated the hospital care rationing standards. Hospitalizations stable over weekend. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in Colorado remained roughly level over the weekend, following a 68% increase since Christmas Day. As of Monday afternoon, 1,655 patients statewide had confirmed cases of the virus. About 93% of general hospital beds and 92% of intensive care beds were full. Estimates of the number of people primarily hospitalized for COVID-19 have varied considerably amid the surge fueled by the virus's fast-spreading Omicron variant. It remains unclear what effect COVID-19 is having on patients not being treated primarily for the virus, how many needed care for something completely unrelated to an asymptomatic infection, and how many had a chronic condition exacerbated by the virus. Some signs pointed to possible relief for Colorado in the near future. Following a nearly month-long surge, the percentage of tests coming back positive has been dropping for about a week, though at 27%, it's still well above levels that would indicate the state has a good handle on the size of the surge. Generally, when the positivity rate drops, cases and hospitalizations follow in the coming weeks. COVID-19 deaths in Colorado have continued to drop following their last peak amid the fall surge of the Delta variant, but people are still dying, with the statewide total recently exceeding 11,000 deaths due to the virus. At this point, it's too early to be certain if the Omicron peak has passed, though, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health. And even when cases stop rising, it will take time for hospitalizations to fall, and many people still will be contagious, she said. We remain at unprecedented levels of cases and very high levels of hospitalizations, she said. We aren't out of the woods yet. Staffing shortage causes backup. The Emergency Physicians Group presented their letter, first reported by Colorado Public Radio, to a member of Polis's staff during a virtual meeting last week. It also asked the state to explain to the public who is eligible for certain COVID-19 treatments and how to get them, offer incentives for nurses to take permanent jobs in Colorado or to stay in their current jobs, set clear rules on when staff infected with COVID-19 can work, bring in more nurses from the National Guard or the Federal Emergency Management Agency, improve the statewide transfer center, which doesn't always have the staff to answer when hospitals call looking for available beds. Reimburse ambulance providers for time spent transferring patients between hospitals. Polis's office didn't respond to questions about the letter from the Denver Post on Monday. Hospitals have a staffing shortage, so they've had to stop using some of their beds, Dollowell said. That means patients who need a hospital bed are sometimes spending hours in the emergency department, waiting for one to become available, and occupying rooms that then aren't available to treat others coming in behind them. Those who don't have life-threatening conditions then have to get basic care in the waiting room until space becomes available. The shortage isn't just in medical staff. It's even in people to clean beds, he said. One of the simplest ways to ease some of the strain in emergency departments would be to increase access to testing and to explain to the public where they can get care if they don't have a life-threatening condition, Dollowell said. People come to hospitals when they don't know where to get tested or can't get an appointment, but that clogs up the system. And many emergency departments don't even have tests available for people who don't need to be admitted, he said. The state can do small things to help us decompress, he said. Some hospitals have essentially declared their own crisis standards, limiting non-emergency surgeries, or setting their own rules about when sick employees need to come back to work, Dollowell said. The state could require hospitals to be transparent about their practices to ensure that some aren't handling the brunt of emergency patients because others keep doing surgeries that could be postponed, he said. The hospital crisis standards, updated in late November, call for the state to halt non-emergency surgeries before allowing any rationing of care. For the patients deemed lowest risk, crisis standards could mean being sent home with oxygen and instructions to monitor their symptoms, or being discharged from the hospital earlier than normal. The standards instruct emergency doctors to consider special circumstances, such as whether a patient is homeless. That takes time, though, which further exacerbates the emergency room backup, Dollowell said. The standards for the sickest patients focus on their odds of surviving for the next year, patients would be assigned a score based on how well their organs are functioning, with additional points added for age and conditions that might kill them in the near future, such as cancer or advanced liver disease. A hospital then sets a cutoff number of points based on how many patients they currently have that need a particular resource and how many more patients they expect to come in that day. Patients whose point totals are above that cutoff would receive a lower level of care, a general bed instead of an ICU bed, for example. The biggest things that members of the public can do to help improve the situation are go to a primary care doctor or urgent care if they don't think their symptoms are life-threatening, wear masks to reduce the virus's spread, and get vaccinated, which makes it less likely they'll become severely ill, Dhaliwal said. While Omicron causes more breakthrough infections among vaccinated people, most of those who are hospitalized with the virus are unvaccinated, he said. This is not a political thing, he said. This is life and death. CDC faces issue of imperfect science by Apoorva Mandavilli, the New York Times company. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was long revered for its methodical and meticulous scientific approach. Agencies in other nations modeled themselves after the world's most highly regarded public health authority, even adopting the name. At the outset of the pandemic, the CDC moved at its accustomed pace, but this time, with the novel virus moving so quickly, the country paid a price. Testing and surveillance lagged as the agency tried to implement dated approaches with creaky infrastructure. Officials were late to recommend masking, in part because federal scientists took too long to recognize that the virus was airborne. Now the contagious Omicron variant is pushing the CDC into uncharted territory. Because decisions must be made at a breakneck pace, the agency has issued recommendations based on what once would have been considered insufficient evidence. Amid growing public concern about how these guidelines affect the economy and education, the agency's director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, has sometimes skipped much of the traditional scientific review process, most recently in shortening the isolation period for infected Americans. After the Trump administration's pattern of interference, President Joe Biden came to office promising to restore the CDC's reputation for independence and rigorous science. The challenge now for Walensky is figuring out how to convey this message to the public. The science is incomplete, and this is our best advice for now. For a bureaucracy staffed primarily by medical professionals, the change has not been easy. In recent interviews, some officials at the CDC privately described the decisions as demoralizing and worried about Walensky's increasing reliance on a small group of advisors and what they saw as the White House's heavy political influence on her actions. And yet others outside the agency commended Walensky for short-circuiting a laborious process and taking a pragmatic approach to managing a national emergency, saying she was right to move ahead, even when the data was unclear and agency researchers remained unsure. There are policy considerations in a pandemic that are not the sole purview of CDC, said Dr. Richard Besser, who served as interim chief of the agency during the H1N1 influenza virus outbreak of 2009. But, he added, I think we need some more clarity when policy and economics drive agency recommendations. As of Sunday, more than 800,000 Americans on average are being infected daily, according to data gathered by the New York Times. Many schools and businesses are struggling to remain open. Hospitals in nearly two dozen states are nearing capacity. At the end of December, Walensky announced that infected Americans would need to isolate for only 5 days, not 10, if they were no longer experiencing symptoms, and that a negative test result would not be required to end the isolation period. Critics complained that the virus might spread as contagious people were allowed to return to offices and schools. Many pointed out that the research supporting a shortened isolation period for Omicron infections was scant. But the recommendations had an important advantage. It could help keep hospitals, businesses, and schools afloat through the worst of the Omicron surge. The recommendations for isolation are basically correct, said Dr. Thomas Frieden, who led the agency under President Barack Obama. The problem is they were not explained. Walensky and the CDC declined requests for comment on new tensions in the agency's decision-making, but the director has frequently cited rapidly evolving science as justification for recommendations that proved to be confusing or unpopular. On the Sunday night after Christmas, Walensky called an emergency meeting of the agency's COVID-19 response leaders. She told them the agency would shrink the recommended isolation period and would drop a negative test result as a requirement for leaving isolation, according to an official familiar with the video call who spoke on condition of anonymity because the individual is not authorized to speak on the matter. The new guidance would be made public the next day, Walensky said, and officials were not to discuss it until then. Stunned, the scientists scrambled to gather the limited data to support the recommendations and to rewrite the hundreds of pages on the agency's website that touch on quarantine and isolation. Before publishing a new recommendation, federal researchers normally pore over data, write a draft, and fine-tune it based on comments from others. There was so little evidence for shortened isolation, and even that was based mostly on the Delta variant, that the science brief that typically accompanies guidance was downgraded to a rationale document. Some researchers bristled at being left out of the decision-making process and were enraged by the agency's public statement the next day that the change was motivated by science. Although some believed the new 5-day cutoff was arbitrary, they also knew of data suggesting that rapid tests might miss some Omicron infections, and so mostly agreed with Walensky's decision not to require a negative test result before ending isolation. But when Walensky informed staff of the new recommendations in the emergency meeting December 26, they were far from ready. Over the next week, CDC scientists struggled to adjust hundreds of guidance documents on the agency's website. About 2,000 health officials, public health lab directors, and public health researchers at the state and city levels joined a weekly call with CDC officials. On the call December 27th, just hours before the CDC released its statement, state and local officials peppered agency scientists with questions about the plans for isolation guidance for the general public. Under strict orders to not talk about the new recommendations, CDC staff members were silent. "We would have appreciated more opportunity for input and heads up," said Scott Becker, CEO of the Association of Public Health Laboratories. Walensky's supporters said the pivot by the CDC was inevitable and that she had made the right calls. "The agency is a behemoth, filled with researchers accustomed to taking their time, and the pandemic needed more urgent solutions. There are people at CDC who really don't get it," Frieden said. Voting rights. Senate Dems pressing ahead to debate bills, by Katie Edmondson, The New York Times Company. Byline, Washington. Senate Democrats plan to press ahead this week with an effort to push new voting rights protections through Congress. In an all but doomed attempt to enact a key piece of President Joe Biden's agenda that has been undercut by members of his own party, the Senate on Tuesday is expected to begin debating legislation that combines two separate bills already passed by the House, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, and folds them into an unrelated measure. The move would allow the Senate to bring the bill directly to the floor, avoiding an initial filibuster. But that strategy will still allow Republicans to block it from coming to a final vote, and Democrats lack the unanimous support needed in their party to change Senate rules to muscle through the legislation themselves. Still, Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, Majority Leader, said late last week that Democrats would forge ahead anyway, forcing Republicans to publicly declare their opposition to the bill. We all have to be recorded at this moment in time about where we are in protecting the right to vote, Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, said on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. Right now, it doesn't look like it has the votes to pass, but we're going to cancel our Martin Luther King Day recess and be there this week because we think it's so important for the country. The push to proceed, even in the face of almost certain failure, reflects the party's conundrum, facing two key defections in its ranks and a wall of Republican opposition. It comes days after a critical Democrat, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, emphatically announced that she would not support undermining the filibuster to pass legislation under any circumstances, and Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, reiterated the same position. Kaine suggested Sunday that other paths around the filibuster existed, including narrowly altering it explicitly to pass the voting rights bill and lengthening the debate time in an effort to pass the bill on a simple majority vote. But privately, Democrats have been less sanguine, especially after a remarkable speech delivered by Sinema on the Senate floor Thursday, just hours before Biden was scheduled to lobby Democrats on the bill. The speech, in which she declared unwavering opposition to altering the filibuster, sent a fresh wave of fury through the Democratic ranks. These two Democrats have decided that it is much more important to them to protect the voting rights of the minority on the Senate floor than to protect the voting rights of minorities in this great country of ours, the minorities that have made it possible for them to be in the position that they're currently in. Representative James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, Majority Whip, said on ABC's This Week on Sunday, "So I hope, but I don't think, that we will change their mind. The Freedom to Vote Act contains a slate of proposals to establish nationwide standards for ballot access in an effort to counteract the wave of new restrictions in states. It would require states to allow a minimum of 15 consecutive days of early voting and that all voters are able to request to vote by mail, establish new automatic voter registration programs, and make Election Day a national holiday." The second measure, named for Representative John Lewis, the civil rights icon who died in 2020, would restore parts of the landmark Voting Rights Act weakened by Supreme Court rulings. Among the provisions was one mandating that jurisdictions with a history of discrimination win prior approval or preclearance from the Justice Department or federal courts in Washington before changing their voting rules. MLK Day, Our Democracy Stands on the Brink of Serious Trouble, by Jeff Martin and Michael Warren, The Associated Press, byline Atlanta. A day before the U.S. Senate was expected to take up significant legislation on voting rights that is looking likely to fail, Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest son condemned federal lawmakers over their inaction. Speaking in Washington, D.C. on Monday, Martin Luther King III said though he was marking the federal holiday named for his father, he wasn't there to celebrate. He was there to call on Congress and President Joe Biden to pass the sweeping legislation that would help ease Republican-led voting restrictions passed in at least 19 states that makes it more difficult to cast a ballot. "Our democracy stands on the brink of serious trouble without these bills," he said. Monday's holiday marked what would have been the 93rd birthday of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who was just 39 when he was assassinated in 1986 while helping sanitation workers strike for better pay and workplace safety in Memphis, Tennessee. Around the U.S., other holiday events included marches in several cities, acts of service in King's name, and the annual Martin Luther King Jr. service at the slain civil rights leader's Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, where U.S. Senator Raphael Warnock is the senior pastor. Pews have been packed by politicians in past years, but given the pandemic, many gave either pre-recorded or live-streamed remarks instead, including Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Biden said Americans must commit to King's unfinished work, delivering jobs and justice, and protecting the sacred right to vote, a right from which all other rights flow. It's time for every elected official in America to make it clear where they stand, Biden said. It's time for every American to stand up, speak out, be heard. Where do you stand? Democrats had hoped to vote on the legislation Monday in a show of respect for the late civil rights leader as the issue gathered political steam late last year and peaked with a powerful, blunt speech last week by Biden, who likened the January 6, 2021 violence and election subversion of today with the civil rights struggles fought by King and others. But it comes too late for many civil rights leaders. Senate Republicans remain unified in opposition to the Democrats' voting bills, and the 50-50 chamber needs 60 votes to pass the legislation. Two Democrats, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, remain opposed to changing Senate rules that would allow for the Democrats to pass the bills without the GOP. The vote was pushed back to Tuesday, but it looks as if there is no way through for the legislation to protect the right to vote. King told of how his father also faced a pushback on civil rights by those who believed the issue could not be solved with legislation. They told him he had to change hearts first, and he worked hard at that. After all, he was a Baptist preacher. But he knew that when someone is denying you your fundamental rights, conversation and optimism won't get you very far. Sinema has argued that bipartisanship is needed to address the issue. But King countered that significant milestones, including the 14th Amendment that granted citizenship to former slaves, passed Congress without bipartisan support. Harris was meeting Monday with lawmakers ahead of the vote, working to get the legislation passed. But when asked specifically about her message to Sinema and Manchin, she didn't engage directly. As I've said before, there are 100 members of the United States Senate, and I'm not going to absolve, nor should any of us absolve, any member of the United States Senate from taking on a responsibility to follow through on the oath that they all took to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, she said. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the Senate's only black Republican, countered with a series of King Day-themed videos he said would emphasize positive developments on civil rights. Scott sidestepped criticism about GOP actions and accused Biden of labeling Republicans as racist. To compare or conflate people who oppose his positions as being racist or traitors to the country is not only insulting and infuriating, it's dead wrong, Scott told the Associated Press. To the sparse crowd at Ebenezer, Warnock, now running for re-election as Georgia's first black senator, said that everybody loves Dr. King. They just don't always love what he represents. Let the word go forth. You cannot remember Dr. King and dismember his legacy at the same time, Warnock said. If you will speak his name, you have to stand up for voting rights. You have to stand up on behalf of the poor and the oppressed and the disenfranchised. Other leaders weighed in too. Former President Barack Obama shared a picture of King's granddaughter, Yolanda, admiring a bust of King that Obama kept in the Oval Office. The fight for voting rights takes perseverance, Obama tweeted. As Dr. King said, there are no broad highways to lead us easily and inevitably to quick solutions. We must keep going. King saw a great injustice in his world and fought to right that wrong. Republican Georgia Governor Brian Kemp said in a recorded message played at Ebenezer, his methods ultimately led to success and showed all of us that taking the high road is the best path to achieving lasting change. Democrat Stacey Abrams, trying again to defeat Kemp as he seeks re-election, tweeted that King's call remains clear. Deliver justice for the poor, protect those targeted by hate, defend the freedom to vote, and demand that our leaders fight current malice as the best bulwark against future harm. King, who delivered his historic I Have a Dream speech while leading the 1963 March on Washington and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, considered racial equality inseparable from alleviating poverty and stopping war. His insistence on nonviolent protests continues to influence activists pushing for civil rights and social change. Martin Luther King Jr., Thousands Gather as Marade Returns to the Streets, by Taylor Shaw, The Denver Post. Wearing a purple shirt bearing the message, "Proud of the skin I'm in," Denver resident Berlin-born carried two signs with her to the Martin Luther King Jr. Marade, including a framed drawing of King alongside Malcolm X, and athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos fists aloft in their iconic pose from the 1968 Olympics. "This one I bring every year," she said. Bourne's been attending the Denver Marade in person once again Monday after going virtual last year due to the pandemic for about 25 years, and said she used to bring her two children when they were younger. But now that they're 26 and 28, she takes pictures and video of the Marade to send back to them in Georgia, where they now live. "Everybody can be a part of this," she said, adding that she hopes the community gets involved just as people did during the civil rights movement. "We still need that same drive today and take the same action that they took. Thousands of people gathered in Denver to honor King's legacy and participate in the 37th annual march and parade along Colfax Avenue from City Park to Civic Center downtown." Holding her 5-year-old daughter, Lucille Jacobs, Emily Lay, who recently moved to the Denver area from Texas, said it felt a little surreal to be surrounded by so many people. When asked what the day represents to her, Lay said, "My daughter is biracial, so it represents a world where she can be herself and not have to worry about any of the things that we had to worry about in the time of Martin Luther King Jr." The day's events began at City Park, where a memorial statue of King stands, and local speakers and politicians reflected on the slain civil rights leader's work and the progress that still has to be made. "We have gone backwards, and as a generation, we have dropped the ball," said Denver Mayor Michael Hancock, noting that legislation passed in 19 states to restrict voting access shows his generation has dropped the baton from the previous generation. "I have a dream today that you pick up that baton as you walk down Colfax Avenue today and you realize the power of that baton that was handed off to us," Hancock said. Other Colorado elected officials at the event, including U.S. Senators Michael Bennett and John Hickenlooper, shared a similar message about the importance of protecting voting rights, especially as the U.S. Senate is scheduled to debate Tuesday on Democratic-sponsored legislation meant to counter Republican-led voting restrictions at the state level. "This is a huge fight that we're in right now. It's a fight for our democracy," Bennett said. Keynote speakers included former Denver Mayor Wellington Webb, who, while in the State House, repeatedly introduced legislation to establish an official Colorado holiday in King's honor, and his wife and former state representative Wilma Webb, who successfully got legislation passed to create the state holiday in 1984. A little after 11:30 a.m., thousands of people marched down Colfax to Civic Center, where crowds gathered for more speeches and performances. Among those marching were Kyle Johnsbury, 21, and his mother, Shauna, 52. Both white, Shauna explained that it was her son's 10 years dancing at Cleo Parker Robinson Dance that opened her eyes to the discrimination black people face. Surrounded by families, she said the march is important because it offers a tangible experience for kids. "Kids learn more when they're doing than when they're sitting," said Shauna Johnsbury, a resident of Strasburg in Adams County. "They feel like they're included." Because the Marade began later than planned, Aurora resident Mary Hayes Olubadewo and her 4-year-old daughter Grace feared they'd miss it as they waited to join the march from near the Capitol building, Hayes Olubadewo said. But soon enough, she said she could hear the sound of drums. They were like the sound of a heartbeat. "We could feel the energy before they even came over the hill," Hayes Olubadewo said. "It was amazing." As a minority woman who is a small business owner, Hayes Olubadewo said it was encouraging to see so much support from her community and from allies. We're just happy that it's still important to all these people, Hayes Alabaduwu said. We still have a long way to go. Marshall Fire. Nadine Turnbull, 91, still missing over 2 weeks later, by Kiernan Nicholson and Noelle Phillips, The Denver Post. More than 2 weeks after the Marshall Fire raced through Superior, investigators still can't say anything definitive about the fate of 91-year-old Nadine Turnbull, who was reported as missing by family members after her home on the edge of town burned to the ground. Turnbull was at home in the 1500 block of South 76th Street with her adult granddaughter, Layla Cornell, when flames engulfed their house, according to a GoFundMe online fundraiser organized by a friend of the family. Cornell managed to escape, but Turnbull was last seen inside. The Boulder County Sheriff's Office said the investigation into the possible death of a second person in the December 30th wildfire remains ongoing, and a spokeswoman would not identify Turnbull by name, though her family has publicly identified her as the person still missing. The identification of a decedent, once it is determined there is a decedent, is done by the Boulder County Coroner's Office. Carrie Haverfield, a sheriff's spokeswoman, said in an email to the Denver Post. In the days after the Marshall Fire, Sheriff Joe Pelley said at least two people remain missing. One of them, Robert Sharp, was confirmed dead on January 7th by the county coroner after investigators found partial human remains in the 5900 block of Marshall Road, where he lived. His remains were identified through DNA and circumstances at the scene. Sharp received an in-person evacuation notice, although Haverfield did not say who visited his property to tell him to evacuate. Sharp chose not to leave, she said in an email. He also was not registered for cell phone alerts through the city's Everbridge notification system and did not have a landline enrolled in the program. Pushed by hurricane-force winds, the Marshall Fire destroyed more than 1,000 homes and burned more than 6,000 acres in Superior, Louisville, and unincorporated Boulder County, making it the most destructive wildfire in state history. Experts warn similar fires could become more commonplace amid a changing climate. Snow and wintry weather on December 31st helped put an end to the wildfire, but also made the investigative task of finding evidence about what happened to Turnbull difficult. The uncertainty has weighed heavily on Turnbull's family and neighbors, especially since they tried to rescue her as flames overtook the house. Neighbor Scotty Roberts told CBS Denver that he barely escaped his family's home in the fire and went to Turnbull's house to tell her to get out, asking a sheriff's deputy to come with him. However, as soon as the front door opened and let air inside, the fire went whoosh and intensified, he said. Cornell, Turnbull's granddaughter, escaped. But Turnbull was tethered to her dogs, and the leashes were wrapped around a table, the station reported. I couldn't pull all of them and the table with me at the same time, said Roberts, who described the fire as being everywhere at that point. He said he was sorry and ran, said Roberts, who shook with emotion during the interview. Haverfield, the Boulder County Sheriff's spokeswoman, declined to answer questions about whether any first responders went to the home and whether anyone attempted to evacuate Turnbull, citing the ongoing investigation. Savannah Garcia Martinez, great-granddaughter of Turnbull, told Denver 7 that Turnbull had a bubbly, welcoming personality. She's just like the cutest little old lady. She's super short and just sweet. And as soon as you walk into the door, she's just there to greet you, Garcia Martinez said after the fire. A GoFundMe campaign has been created to benefit Cornell, who is splitting time living with her sisters until a more permanent solution is found. She wants to live near family who can help with daily living, the fundraising website said. Cornell also lost two horses, two goats, and two dogs in the fire. She has always had her grandma, who has been her mom, to take care of her throughout her life, Amy Smith, a family friend, wrote on the website. It's been really, really hard, Smith told the Post. We're just doing what we can to help them. In the days after the fire, authorities told Turnbull family members that the Superior property was searched with dogs, but they hadn't confirmed any human remains. Two horses were confirmed dead, while two goats and two dogs were considered missing. We're trying to get her home as soon as we can because we all love and miss her, and we don't want to start this year like this, Joseph Henry Turnbull, her grandson, told Denver 7 just after the fire. Lessons from Lions. Best to rebuild or walk away? Marshall fire victims facing same question flood victims did in 2013. By John Aguilar, The Denver Post. Byline, Lions. Just 30 feet beyond Linda Hubbard's kitchen window is the river that upended her life nearly a decade ago. It was 2013, and the North St. Vrain River, swollen angry with too much water in too little time, hurled boulders, propane tanks, and tree limbs into Lyons on a dark September night. A pedestrian bridge just upstream became unmoored from its foundations and swiveled hard into Hubbard's black walnut tree, catching there and forming an unwanted diversion dam. When it did that, it rerouted the river right into the house, said Hubbard, now 72. From there, mud, silt, and debris poured into the home she'd owned since 1981, sending Hubbard and hundreds of her fellow residents in Lyons packing for higher ground. Just a few blocks away, Donna Boone watched the water rise and rise that same September night from inside her trailer at the Riverbend Mobile Home Park. When I started loading the car, the water was up to my ankles, she said. When I was finished loading the car, it was up to my knees. While the same raging river hit both homes with the same destructive force nearly 8 years ago, what happened next to Boone and Hubbard couldn't have been more different. Boone now lives in Loveland with no plans to return to the town she called home for 36 years. Hubbard is back in her 4th Avenue house, rebuilt bigger and elevated nearly 5 feet off the ground. I own the land. I've been there a long time, she said. I wanted to rebuild and be back home. The choices the two women made following the 2013 Colorado floods will be echoed over the coming months and years by the nearly 1,100 families in and around Louisville and Superior who lost their homes to the Marshall Fire on December 30th. Build or walk away. Pull out stakes or dig in deeper. Stay or go. Andy Rumbach, a professor at Texas A&M University and a faculty fellow at the school's Hazard Reduction and Recovery Center, worked closely with flood survivors in Lyons when he was teaching at the University of Colorado, Denver. For a lot of folks, they want to be part of their community. They want to plug back into their networks, he said. There's no neat plug-in formula to determine who rebuilds and who moves on after a natural disaster, Rumbach said. That decision depends on a multitude of factors that vary with every person impacted. The level of insurance coverage in force, the cost to rebuild, proximity to retirement age, and the sense of belonging within a community. But many in Boulder County will fight the red tape and endure the delays to put their lives back together right where they were before, Rumbach said. There's a stickiness to place, he said. Flood turned Lyons richer. The 2013 flood destroyed or damaged approximately 200 homes in Lyons, or about 20% of the housing stock in the town of 2000. The town's infrastructure and utilities sustained around $75 million in damage from the rushing waters of both the north and south forks of the St. Vrain River, which come together in what turned out to be a devastating confluence at the west end of town. More notable was the flood's impact to Lyons' already constrained supply of affordable housing. Because the mode of disaster was water rather than fire, the Federal Emergency Management Agency bought up dozens of lots in the town's floodway and placed them off limits to future habitation. That included two low-lying mobile home parks with 50 homes between them. We did lose nearly 100% of our affordable housing, said Lyons Town Administrator Victoria Simonson, who's been in the position for more than a decade. And what it's done is totally gentrify the community and not allow anyone in who needs affordable housing. Median home prices in Lyons, she said, have leaped from around $350,000 in 2013 to more than $800,000 today. For Boone, 76, returning to Lyons wasn't an option once her trailer was totaled by the flood. Not only would Riverbend Mobile Home Park soon be no more, but home prices were on an inexorable rise across the entire region. The former hairdresser used FEMA funds to settle in a mobile home park in Loveland. "I couldn't afford to live there anymore," Boone said. "It feels more like Boulder today than Lyons. It doesn't feel like home anymore." Rumbach at Texas A&M said Lyons became less diverse and richer in the wake of the flood. That's evident to Simonson, who said she ran into three families over the holidays who had just moved to town from New York City. And a steady list of utility shutoffs she used to receive on a monthly basis has shrunk to just a handful. "That's telling me we don't have people having needs in that area," Simonson said. Hubbard, who waited 5 years to rebuild her home in the Confluence area of town, said there's been an influx of people into Lyons in recent years. "The people who are coming in want to Boulderfy Lyons," she said, noting her distaste for a recently proposed 50,000-square-foot hotel downtown. "Things that used to be on Main Street are there no more." Only now is affordable housing set to go up in Lyons, a 40-unit project off of Carter Drive. It comes nearly 7 years after voters in the town rejected setting aside land in Bond Park for replacement, low-cost housing after the flood. Lori Peek, a University of Colorado at Boulder sociology professor and director of the university's Natural Hazards Center, said natural disasters have the greatest impact on the poor, people of color, single mothers, people with disabilities, and renters. "What we have seen in disaster after disaster, those who were most vulnerable at the time of the disaster experienced the most complicated and protracted recovery processes," she said. 16 years after Hurricane Katrina, Peek said New Orleans still has 25% fewer residents than it had before the storm, and those who remain are more likely to be white and more likely to be homeowners than renters. While the neighborhoods destroyed by the Marshall Fire didn't face anywhere near the socioeconomic challenges that the Crescent City faced before Hurricane Katrina hit, that doesn't mean there won't be residents of Louisville and Superior facing pressure to leave. "Even people who are insured, they often struggle with disasters because they may soon learn they are underinsured or not insured for the disaster that happened to them," Peek said. "Sometimes people end up giving up." Recovery isn't made any easier by the seemingly endless rise in home prices along the Front Range. Seattle-based Zillow is calling for a 17.5% gain in Metro Denver home sales over the next 12 months, which comes on top of a record-setting 22.1% gain in 2021, according to the company. You can look at the real estate prices from 2013 and now in Lyons, and the prices have tripled, said Scott Kelly, who moved to Loveland after the flood, took out his home in Lyons. Kelly hasn't completely left Lyons in the rearview mirror. He still runs his Gateway Auto Service shop on Fifth Avenue in town, but he said Lyons didn't feel the same after 2013. "It's changed," he said. Every reason to be hopeful. Susanna Long, an engineering professor at the Missouri University of Science and Technology who studies natural disasters, said a major part of recovery has little to do with insurance coverage or the cost of materials. "There needs to be targeted efforts to restore trust and confidence," she said. She points to the success of the recovery effort in Joplin, Missouri, where a tornado ripped through town in May 2011, killing 161 in injuring more than 1,000 others. Total damage from the event, $2.8 billion. Long said the community, including hundreds of volunteers, banded together to bring the city back. A citizens advisory recovery team formed to help guide the rebuilding effort. Structures in the city were brought back to more vigorous building standards. And a few years after the disaster, many pointed to Joplin's efforts as a way to come back from tragedy. If you take a look at a community like Joplin and look at satellite imagery and chart the progress, it's like new growth after the winter, Wong said. There's every reason to be hopeful and confident in regions of Colorado that have been impacted like this. But it won't come without bumps and challenges. In Lyons, friction developed between town and its residents during the rebuilding effort. Residents of Superior and Louisville should expect things to get worse before they get better, Simonson said. It will start happening around Valentine's Day, she said. I think people are going to start getting very frustrated. Anger will start, then resentment will start to bubble. What happens is everyone wants to rebuild back now. Hubbard remembers the confrontations with federal and local officials as residents desperately tried to pull the proper permits to proceed with construction and restoration. She remembers meeting weekly with her neighbors and making sure they presented a united front before the town. We walked to town hall as a group, all 30 of us, she said. It was probably intimidating, but the recovery continued and the town is now stronger for it, with better designed bridges spanning the St. Vrain and many houses in town now elevated on concrete pads. The town is readying construction of a new pedestrian bridge over the North Fork of the river to replace the one demolished by the flood. Peak, the CU professor, said neighborhoods torched by the Marshall Fire may have a few cards in their pocket that other disaster areas didn't have. The fact that schools weren't destroyed or as many businesses weren't destroyed, more people might decide to stay, she said. And the work from home revolution brought about by the pandemic could allow displaced Marshall Fire families to temporarily relocate to rental properties while their homes are rebuilt, making the transition from disaster easier than it might have been in the past, Peak said. But Hubbard counsels patience to the thousands displaced by the Marshall Fire. Be patient, because it isn't going to happen overnight, she said. For her, she started out post-flood in 3 emergency shelters, then an assisted living facility in Boulder, then a rented home in Lyons, and finally back to her property, where she camped in a 27-foot RV for the next 2 years, watching her home go back up. Now she looks across her spacious living room to the picture window, outside of which the St. Vrain continues on its course. It's still home, Hubbard said. Hancock nominates 2 more department heads, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. There has been significant turnover at the top of Denver Mayor Michael Hancock's administration as the term-limited mayor enters his final full calendar year in office. Last week, Hancock nominated new leaders for the city's Human Services and Excise and Licenses departments. Jay Morin has been nominated to take the top spot at Denver Human Services, where he now works as chief operating officer, Hancock announced in a news release last week. Nali Duplichian, who took over as interim executive director of the Excise and Licenses Department when longtime head Ashley Kilroy stepped down on January 7th, has been nominated to drop the interim tag from her title and helm the department full-time. Both nominations are subject to city council approval. Morin first started at Denver Human Services as an accountant in 1981, according to last week's news release. Over 3 stints with the department, a wing of city government tasked with connecting Denverites with social services programs and support, he has served as a deputy executive director, chief of staff to departing executive director Don Mayers, and most recently as chief operating officer. Jay has had a long and storied career in human services at both the local and state levels, and his depth of expertise will be a tremendous asset not only to Denver Human Services as its executive director, but also to our entire community and to our neighbors who rely on the support the department provides, Hancock said in a news release. Mayers, a former city auditor appointed by Hancock to lead DHS in 2015, is expected to step down at the end of this month. He's taking a leadership position with the Colorado Trust Foundation. Duplichian has also a long history with the department she is now being asked to lead. She was hired on to the city's Office of Marijuana Policy in 2014, where, alongside the Excise and Licenses Department's now former director, Ashley Kilroy, she helped develop the framework for what the city calls the first legalized marijuana market in the world. She was Kilroy's top deputy when the marijuana office merged with the Department of Excise and Licenses, and Kilroy was appointed director in 2016. The department oversees more than 150 licenses, including in the marijuana, liquor, short-term rental, and restaurant industries. She is more than prepared to continue the work at Excise and Licenses to support her economic recovery, improve the licensing process, and create more equity in the marijuana marketplace, Hancock said in a statement. Hancock now has three department heads in the nomination pipeline. Earlier this month, he nominated another in-house candidate, Armando Saldate, to take over the city's Department of Public Safety and replace the resigning Murphy Robinson. The city is also looking for a full-time head for the Denver Office of Economic Development. That is a position that is not subject to city council review, according to a spokesman in the mayor's office. Hancock's third and final term as mayor ends in the spring of next year after an April election that will decide the mayorship and all 13 city council seats. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.